Jody Loomis, Jessica Baggin, Kelly Ann Prosser, Michelle Martinko, Christy Mirak, Carolyn Rose. Do these names mean anything to you? All these people are murder victims whose cases were cold for decades until recently. They were solved by investigative genetic genealogy. This new crime-solving tool is rapidly providing us with the names of elusive killers. But each one of these cases is unique and worth exploring. Each episode of the DNA ID podcast will focus on one newly solved case and look at the story behind the headline. Who was the victim? Who was their killer? And why did this tragic crime occur? It's brought to you by Abjack Entertainment, hosted and produced by me, Jessica Betancourt, and co-produced by Mike Morford. Make sure you subscribe to DNA ID today, wherever you listen to podcasts, so you don't miss a single episode.
The Oracle Network.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. As always, I'm your host, Paige. Thinking back to when I was a teenager, I didn't have a care in the world, and I walked up and down the road that I still live on every day. I thought I was invincible. I had a bad attitude during that stage of my life and really thought nobody was going to mess with me and that I could protect myself. Nothing had ever happened before on my little country road, and parents were also more lenient to let kids go outside and explore. To think that what happened to these young teenage girls that I'm about to tell you about could happen to any innocent child is profoundly disturbing and disgusting. Yes, walking alone at any age is dangerous, and everyone can be naive and thinking it won't happen to us or our children. But it's also not the victim's fault or the fault of the family. The blame lies on the one who believes they have the right to do these vile, inhumane acts to others. Shouldn't we be free to walk around without this fear of being hurt or killed? I think over the years, as we have become more aware and educated about the darkness that can dwell in a lot of humans, we know we can't do things alone, or we must always carry some kind of defense device. We shouldn't have to, but unfortunately, we need to. A lot of people still say that the 60s and 70s were such a different time. The days where you could leave your doors unlocked, stay gone all day, and just make sure you're back when the streetlights come on. Maybe that mentality carried over into adulthood, and they wanted their children to have that same freedom and experience that they did. However, were they not watching the news back then? Were they oblivious to all of the murders and serial killings happening in the 60s and 70s? They say those times were different, but really, they were terrible times. Maybe everyone was so busy doing their own things that they didn't know what was really going on around them. I have no idea. All I know is my mother has told me that she and her family never really watched the news or knew what was going on because they were busy living their lives and not really paying attention like a lot of us do today. My dad was the same way, always out being a country boy and doing country boy things like fishing and hunting and bullshitting with friends, driving his bike miles and miles to go visit my mom when they were dating, when they were around 15 and 16 years old. Anything could have happened. But this story of the freeway phantom is horrifying, and it brings things into perspective. This could have happened to so many of us in our younger years, but we were the lucky ones. This is the story of children whose lives were not only taken from them, but their bodies were littered like trash on the side of the road. Monsters are very real. Let's get started. Since the 1970s, many investigators have been involved in the unsolved murders of six black female teenagers and children caused by someone only known as the Freeway Phantom. These murders were committed in Washington, D.C., and countless tips have been sent in through a hotline operated by the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. They also received a lot of tips through the mail. Every single lead was investigated. Some were found to not be likely or practical very quickly, and other leads needed an investigative deep dive, but this case still remains unsolved. There are many suspects, but nothing to pin them down as the killer. Carol Denise Spinks was only 13 years old. She was really shy, she was in 7th grade, and was an identical twin. She loved jumping double Dutch rope, playing jacks with her siblings, and she was an extremely talented little hula hooper. On April 25th, 1971, her mom, Allentine, was heading out to go visit her aunt in Brentwood, Maryland. She told the children they could not leave the house. The kids knew if they did, they'd get what I know this to be as an ass whooping, either by hand, a switch from a tree, or a belt, maybe even an extension cord. She was a single mother doing the best she possibly could. Parents often mimic what their parents did to them. I'm not here to judge anyone's parenting. Talking about those kind of spankings definitely gave me flashbacks, though. So, Allentine was gone, and their older sister Valerie, who was 24, asked Carol to go to the 7-Eleven to pick up a few groceries that evening. Some TV dinners, bread, and soda pops. Carol knew if her mom found out that she'd be in big trouble, but she decided to go for it. It was only a half a mile away. This 7-Eleven was right as you entered into Maryland. Well, her mom ended up seeing her, and she said, "You better go straight home after going to the 7-Eleven. And you're gonna get a whoopin' when I get back into town." Carol made it to the 7-Eleven, and she was venturing back home with the groceries, when she was sadly kidnapped. After not making it back home, her mother was on edge, upset, and filed a missing person report that night after they had scoured the neighborhood for Carol. Almost a week later, her body was discovered on May 1st by some kids playing in a grassy location right behind St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Someone had dumped Carol's body on a grassy embankment by the northbound lanes of I-295. She was dressed when she was discovered, but her shoes were nowhere to be found. The children were able to get the attention of police, waving their hands in the air frantically. When Carol's autopsy was finished, the details of what happened to this young girl was just horrific. She had been sodomized, had cuts on her face, neck, chest, and both of her hands, and had been strangled. Carol's nose was covered in blood. She had only been deceased for a few days. Reportedly, green fibers were on her clothes, which we'll circle around again later. Carol also had fruit in her stomach, and some tend to think the person who brutally killed her may have been the last one to feed her, possibly even holding her hostage for a few days. Especially since she had only been deceased about 2 or 3 days prior to being found. At this time, there was a lot going on in the streets. War protesters were everywhere, and authorities wanted officers on the streets to make sure everyone was safe. And authorities needed help with prison control, and needed officers standing by for that as well. It would seem like a murder would be top priority, but to some, that didn't seem to be the case. Darlena Denise Johnson was the second victim. She was from Congress Heights and only 16 years old. On July 8, 1971, she was on her way to her job that she worked during the summer at Oxon Hill Recreation Center. She didn't make it to her job that day. Another young girl kidnapped. After she had been taken, a witness came forward to say they saw her in an older model black car. The driver was said to be a black male. On the 11th day, she was finally found by a D.C. Department of Highways and Traffic employee. He immediately called the police. The officers that were sent to look for her body said they couldn't find anything, and they went on about their way. A week went by. Still, no one knew where she was or if she could possibly be alive. On July 19th, the guy who had called the first time saw that the little girl's body was still there. He was absolutely irate about the police not doing their job. Darlena was only 15 feet away from where Carol's body was found. When she was finally found, it was the same scene, just a different day. She was dressed, but her shoes were gone. Since she was found so late, and being outside all of that time, her body had quickly started decomposing, to the point they couldn't even tell what the cause of her death was. Her face and her body had rotted so much that the medical examiner had to cut her fingers off in order to find out who she was. It couldn't even be determined if she had been sexually abused or not. The only piece of evidence that was discovered was that she had been strangled. Brenda Faye Crockett was only 10 years old. She was friends with everyone she met. She loved posing for a picture and went to church all of the time. On July 27, 1971, her mom sent her to the store around 7 p.m. and she was never seen alive again. But her little sister and mother's boyfriend would hear her voice one last time. The family's phone started to ring around 9:30 that night, and Brenda's 7-year-old sister, Bertha, picked up the phone. Her little sister had been waiting at their house while the rest of the family was going around looking for Brenda. It was Brenda, on the other end of the line, crying, saying, "A white man picked me up, and I'm heading home in a cab. I think I'm in Virginia. Bye." Brenda ended the call, and the phone started to ring again. Brenda's mom's boyfriend answered the phone this time. And again, shockingly, it was Brenda. She basically said what she had said to her little sister, but she asked, "Did my mother see me?" She also gave some clues that she was in some house with a white man, alone and scared. Brenda's boyfriend replied, "How can your mother see you if you're in Virginia?" The boyfriend of Brenda's mother asked if he could get the man to come to the phone and talk. He started to hear these loud footsteps approaching Brenda. She got nervous and whispered, "I'll see you," and ended the call. Authorities came to the conclusion that whoever the killer was probably forced Brenda to call her house and say things that were not true to throw everyone off the trail. This would give the sick man who had her in his grasp time to commit the murder. Maybe he was a white man, and maybe he wasn't. There are so many questions we may never know the answers to. The very next day, Brenda was found by a hitchhiker. As usual, like the other victims, she did not have her shoes on, and her body had been left on U.S. Route 50 by the Baltimore-Washington Parkway in Prince George's County, Maryland. What was awfully strange was that her feet were exceptionally clean, as if they had just been washed. The autopsy revealed that 10-year-old Brenda had been raped and strangled with a scarf that was around her neck, tied in a knot. She also had green synthetic fibers on her clothes, just like Carol Spinks. Nina Mashiya Yates was 12 years old. On October 1st, 1971, she was strolling home from a Safeway store where she was asked to pick up flour, sugar, and paper plates around 7 in the evening. 3 hours after she was snatched up by the killer, her little body was found off the shoulder of Pennsylvania Avenue in Prince George's County in Maryland. A 16-year-old boy stumbled across her body. She had also been raped and choked to death, and she was also shoeless. There were also green fibers on her clothes, and it was never actually determined what these fibers were, but later on there are some guesses. Someone came forward saying they saw Nina Mashiya hopping into a blue Volkswagen. This was investigated, but led to a dead end like most tips did. After Nina Mashiya was found, the daily news articles started calling this murderer the Freeway Phantom. If this were only one person doing this, this would be Washington's first serial killer. Everyone started hounding police, wanting to know if these murders were all linked to each other. The next victim was Brenda Denise Woodard. She was 18 years old, and she went to eat with a friend from high school at Ben's Chili Bowl. They were in Baltimore and took a ride on a city bus around 11:30 at night to go back to her house on Maryland Avenue. Her friend would have driven her home, but his car was being worked on at a shop, which is why they were having to take the bus everywhere. Now that her friend was home, she had to go board another bus by herself to get home. 6 hours after boarding the bus, a policeman on patrol found her lifeless body. Brenda Denise was strangled, and whoever this evil person was, stabbed her many times. She was left in the grass by Prince George's County Hospital. It was right along the access ramp to Route 202 from the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. Things were different about this victim. None of the other victims before her had been stabbed. She was stabbed 4 times with defensive injuries on her hands, so she was definitely trying to fight for her life. She still had on her shoes, and her coat was draped on her chest. She had on a turtleneck shirt, but it was inside out, and buttons were missing from her skirt and her coat. In her pocket, there was a note. It was from the killer. Authorities said that the note was written on paper and cut out from Brenda Denise's notebook that she was carrying. The handwriting was, in fact, Brenda's. The note had evidence of dysgraphia. I'd never heard of this before, but dysgraphia is a writing disability. Some letters may be capitalized, and it has an impact on your fine motor skills and the ability to control your fingers properly. Also, the person could have issues with letters that look alike but are different, like B and D, or P and Q. So the letters had misspelled words and uppercase letters where they should not be. The note said, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you can catch me if you can." It was signed Freeway Phantom, but of course in Brenda's handwriting, since he was telling her what to write. Somehow, they figured out that there was no evidence of intimidation or force in the handwriting, which meant she could have known the person that killed her. In my non-expert opinion, there is a possibility she may not have known him. Romaine Jenkins believes that you do not write that calmly with punctuation, no indication of nervousness when compared to her normal handwriting, and you probably would not write how you normally do if someone was kidnapped and assaulted you. So, maybe she wrote it before he ever attacked her and she did know him. But I just don't know that we can know that for sure. There are also suspicions that maybe this person was a different killer. That he could be pretending to be the Freeway Phantom and hopes to get away with it. The last known victim of the Freeway Phantom was Diane Denise Williams. This happened a year later. Could this person have had a cooling off period after his killing spree? On September 5th, 1972, Diane was 17 years old and a senior at Ballou High School. That afternoon, she came home and she cooked a family meal. Then she went to visit her boyfriend. That night at 11:20, someone said they saw her getting on a bus near her boyfriend's home. Only a few hours later, she was found strangled to death and left on the side of Interstate 295. Reportedly, she had Diane, in all caps, written on one of her white shoes, and in her pocket was $1.26. There was nothing indicating that she had been sexually abused. The only thing that was found was evidence that she and her boyfriend had sex before she left due to his semen being found on her. Detectives from the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia, known as the MPDC, Homicide and Sex Squads, were investigating. There were investigations all the way from Prince George's County and Montgomery County in Maryland, the Maryland State Police, and the FBI. Back in the 1970s, case files at the MPDC detective divisions were kept by the detectives on whatever case that they were working on. Due to that, many of the case files are not all the way finished. Some have even been trashed, and others that had a lot of evidence have gotten mixed up in other files and they cannot find them. The detectives misplaced their notes, and all of these detectives and investigators are either no longer with us or have retired. So many pieces of evidence are gone forever. All leads led to absolutely nowhere. These cases have been closed and opened back and forth over the decades. Right now, the case is cold, but it's open. There is a reward of $150,000 if anyone can provide information that leads to someone being prosecuted for the murders. Romaine Jenkins, who I mentioned earlier, is a retired DC police detective and the only woman to make it to the homicide department. She mainly dealt with the deaths of children and abortions that were illegal back then. She was only in her 20s when these girls were being kidnapped, brutalized, and left on the side of the road like discarded garbage. This case has haunted Romaine Jenkins, who for 24 years has been retired. She can never get these little girls out of her mind. Romaine also questions a lot of things, such as, how did one girl have freshly straightened hair, but when she was sketched, it was shrunk and curly? She wonders if the murderer cleaned the bodies before he disposed of them, which makes a lot of sense. Anytime she hears a mere reference about the girls, she goes straight to her case files and checks them over to make sure she had not overlooked anything, or if she could find something that would be helpful to the case. She said, quote, "I'm truly obsessed with this. No time ever goes by that I don't think about it." Her son is also a police officer. She has a theory about Brenda Crockett and the phone call that she made to her home. She thinks it is possible that the killer knew Brenda's mom, and he was curious to know if she had spotted him with Brenda. Romaine questions why this killer would allow this girl to call home, not just once, but twice. It seems like he was really paranoid and had to make sure Brenda's mother didn't see them. The story of the girls and the freeway phantom seemed to fade from the headlines, and seemingly the public, because after a while, nobody seemed to care about the case anymore. Except, of course, Romaine, the families, and James Trainum, a homicide detective who had last looked into the case in 2009. There may have been very few leads, but there were a number of suspicious suspects. Starting with the Green Vega rapists, a gang that was found guilty for multiple rapes and kidnappings all around Maryland. With the police knowing their MO, they were in the hot seat. Each of the members were interrogated by the MPDC homicide detectives at Lorton Prison in Virginia. There, they were serving their sentences for their heinous crimes. One specific gang member, in the beginning, blamed another one of the gang members. He said this gang member told him directly that he was involved. The gang member being questioned said that he would give them any details, but only if he could stay anonymous. Authorities agreed, and he gave the name of the man who told him everything, such as where the bodies of these little girls were dumped, what day it was, and information you would think only the killer would know. Other details are not allowed for the public to read, but supposedly the details were spot on. The man being interviewed claimed he had nothing to do with those killings, and even gave an alibi, and it ended up being true. Well, because there was an election going on right in the middle of this very serious investigation, and one of the candidates said there was a break in the case, and even said an inmate was the one giving the information, this put a stop to the gang member talking. Obviously, this is something that people should never get on a public platform and say, because it causes the people who are giving the information to shut down, which is exactly what happened. He even denied ever giving anyone any kind of information. Next, there's Edward Sullivan and Tommy Simmons. They seem like likely candidates, too. They are former policemen, and they were arrested for the slaying of 14-year-old Angela Denise Barnes. She was thought to be one of the victims of the Freeway Phantom Killer, But after it was investigated, the two ex-cops were cleared and the investigators kept going, desperately trying to find this mysterious killer who had made everyone around the area scared to leave their homes. Another suspect was a 58-year-old named Robert Askins. Robert was charged in March of 1977 with kidnapping and raping a 24-year-old woman at his home in Washington, D.C. When Lloyd Davis, a homicide detective, started to question Robert, he found out that Robert was charged with murder in the past, several times. When Robert was only 19 on December 28, 1938, he was studying science in college. He gave five sex workers at a brothel whiskey, but it wasn't just plain whiskey. Robert had laced it with cyanide. Ruth McDonald was 31 years old, and the cyanide whiskey was the cause of her death. 2 days after he laced these women's drinks, he went on to find another sex worker. Elizabeth Johnson, only 26 years old at the same brothel. He stabbed her to death. After he was taken into custody, he actually told the police he hated women. Robert was then under mental evaluation at a hospital. He managed to get out of the restraints that they had put him in and grabbed a chair, viciously attacking three employees before he was eventually contained. During his trial, everyone found out that he had been a police informant. He was helping police arrest sex workers. A perfect little job for someone who is out to target women because he hates them. Robert was sent to St. Elizabeth Hospital because in April of 1939, he was declared criminally insane. In April of 1952, he had been free for 5 months. He couldn't take it anymore. Laura Cook, 42 years old, was his next victim. He strangled her to death. In 1954, he was indicted for her murder, and he was the suspect of other attacks that were just alike, and tried again for the murder he committed in 1938 when he gave the sex workers the cyanide-laced whiskey. He was declared to be sane at the time of the killing. Robert even claimed that the cyanide was for him because he was trying to complete suicide. He was found guilty of second-degree murder and was served 20 years to life. However, his conviction was overturned in 1958. After he was charged with rape in 1978, police that were working on the Freeway Phantom murders searched his house. Now, an odd piece of evidence was found. It could have been a little coincidence, but maybe it wasn't. When police were rummaging through his desk, they stumbled upon court documents, and the judge had used the one word that stood out: tantamount. The exact word used in the killer's note. It was not a word that was commonly used, so immediately it was very fishy. Robert was said to use this word all of the time when he talked, according to some of his colleagues at the National Science Foundation where he worked. Police did obtain a warrant to search his home. They dug and searched in his backyard, but no evidence was ever found, so he couldn't be connected to the murders of the little girls. According to a Washington Post article, they also found soiled women's scarves, photos of girls and young women, a knife used in another crime, and an essay from a girl. Another warrant was issued a month later, allowing police to search Robert's vehicle. Records show that they found two buttons and a golden earring under his back seat. Robert was 91 years old, serving time at the Federal Correctional Institution in Cumberland, Maryland, when he kicked the bucket on April 30, 2010. He was questioned about the Freeway Phantom murders, but he said, quote, "I don't have the depravity of mind required to commit any of the crimes." Many believe he was absolutely capable, but you have to have proof, and that is something that tragically has yet to be seen in the case of these six young girls. Victoria Hester spent 2 years researching the case with her father, Blaine Pardoe, and she said, "We definitely think it can be solved. Somebody knows something." He kept textbooks from one of the girls, curlers from another girl, shoelaces from another. Some family member of his may stumble across those things and say, "Why did he keep this junk?" Now, we have to go back to the green fibers. As far as these green fibers being found on the girls, it is suspected and so possible that he gave the girls a bath before dumping their bodies. I mean, Brenda Faye Crockett's feet were so clean that it does seem like he could have bathed them. But also, maybe he didn't. But also, maybe he did not realize when he put their bodies on his bathroom floor, it was picking up small amounts of evidence. Maybe something like fibers from a carpet or bathroom rug. Carol Spinks's sister, Evander, spoke out to the Washington Post in 2006, saying, quote, "You better bet that if these had been white girls, the police would have solved the cases. They didn't care about us. All of the cases involving white girls still get publicity, but ours have been forgotten." Even retired MPDC veteran Tommy Musgrove said in the same article, quote, "If those girls had been white, they would have put more manpower on it. There's no doubt about that." Oddly enough, there was one DNA sample of semen sent off to be examined in 2009, but nobody ever knew the results, and nobody knows why. MPD never has responded to any questions surrounding this matter. Diane, the little girl who never made it home from her boyfriend's house, her sister Patricia became a police officer, and she investigated missing persons and child abuse cases for 26 years. She also eventually moved on to be a case manager with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Patricia is now retired. She said, "I will not be surprised that I will die not knowing who killed my sister, but I'm never going to stop praying that I do." With the murder stopping in 1972, it's speculated that he is possibly incarcerated, dead, or moved away from the area. And that concludes this episode of The Freeway Phantom and the little girls that he took the lives of. And don't forget, if you or someone you know knows anything about this case, to get in contact with the Metropolitan Police Department. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, you know the drill. Stay safe and take care.